Reading this morning is from John chapter 2, verses 1 through 5. John chapter 2, verses 1 through 5. On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you."
Morning. I chased rabbits all week. I started out at the beginning of the week knowing I was going to preach on John chapter 2, 1 through 11. And I had my sermon done the first time on Monday. It was rewritten seven more times. Seven makes it perfect, right? So we're finished? No. I just kept finding more questions that I was interested in, and then at some point you say, you can't answer every question in a sermon. At some point you have to kind of land the plane, and so I started taking things back out. You'll be glad. Taking things out, deciding what I actually had time to cover and what I didn't. And eventually kind of arrived at, okay, what this time through, I've preached this passage before, what this time through was the question I had that caught my attention more than any other that would have something meaningful to say to our church. And what I finally landed on, of many things I'm going to have to bypass, a question I had and have had relates to this passage's most controversial verse. It's actually in verse 4. It's controversial not because of any particular doctrine that comes out of it. Jesus has lots more doctrinally controversial things to say. It's difficult because it doesn't sound very nice. So depending on how you read verse 4, what tone of voice you take to it, it can come across as an almost belligerent thing to say to a man's mother. "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come," is not the correct way to read it. Let me just give you the hint there, right? That kind of gives away what you think he might have had in mind. I'll even go so far as to say, because of the way the word woman is sometimes used in modern English, I think if Jesus were standing in front of us, he wouldn't say it that way because of how our ears would hear it. But in that place and time and culture, the language he used actually makes a little more sense than we probably give it credit for. And it was studying that line that led to the following thoughts. Why is it that Jesus says this? "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." To give us some sense of what it may mean and why it might be actually very important and ominous, we need to take a little bit of a look at the setting in this particular text. Who is Jesus in John chapter 2? All you have to do is look back at John chapter 1, and the correct answer is almost nobody. In John chapter 1, Jesus is not yet famous. He has had a public interaction with John the Baptist, but John the Baptist is definitely the more notable figure. People knew who John the Baptist was. Jesus is the man that John the Baptist pointed at one time and baptized. That's all really we know about Jesus. Jesus doesn't yet have disciples. He has five at this point, not our well-known set of 12 or hundreds or 70 or mobs of people. Nothing like this. At this point, he has five disciples that are named in the text, most of which were borrowed from John. They were disciples of John, and when John says, "That's the man," they start following Jesus. These aren't people that were particularly interested in him. They were disciples of John who became interested in Jesus because of John. But he has all of five. He's not a particularly famous person. And at this point in his life, he's also not doing anything particularly interesting. Jesus at this time, according to verse 43 of chapter 1, is traveling in Galilee, which is kind of his home stomping grounds. This is where he grew up and spent a fair portion of his life, up in the northern part of Palestine. And he's traveling around there. And while he's passing through, one of his kinfolk, apparently, is having a wedding in Cana of Galilee. A little word about travel and hospitality in the ancient world and weddings, too. Weddings are a big deal. Weddings are a big deal. It's a feast, and it may last several days. It's a community event. Work stops. right? This is not a world where we have nice, clean 8-hour days and union rules and stuff like that. People worked really hard. So when it came time for weddings, we stop. And we just, the whole community shuts down for a wedding. And the family would provide, you know, feasting and gifts and all sorts of things to the people who came, right? We do it all backwards. We bring the married couple a gift. They're supposed to give me stuff just for being there. That's the way it works in the ancient world. There's a feast, there's a gift, which is a big deal because Cana of Galilee is a fairly poor rural community. At this time in history, it's not a wealthy, well-to-do region. This is a country family trying to celebrate the best they're able, the wedding of two young people in their community. It's a time to be happy in a world that often didn't give you a lot to be happy about. And so they throw a feast. Jesus is passing through. And what are the rules of hospitality? Hey, he's family. Of course he's invited. The whole town's invited. So of course he's invited, and he's expected to be there. And so he attends. And that's the setting in chapter 1. So in chapter 2, that's where we pick up in verses 1 and 2. On the third day, can I just pause there for just one moment? That many words in. In your mind, put a little note there, because I want to come back to it, because that sentence, that part of the sentence makes no sense whatsoever. On the third day of what? On the third day of the month, third day of the year, third day of the week, third day since the first day, third day of the feast, third today. I don't know what third day means. John doesn't tell you anything about it, just it was the third day. On the third day of something or other, maybe of the feast itself, the following events happened. I want to come back to that because I think it's interesting. On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. And again, when you see the words invited, don't take that to mean he received an engraved invitation. It means he was passing through, and they said, oh, of course, you're here. Well, of course, you're invited, your family. So come on in, have something to eat. At this point in Jesus' life, nothing else is going on. There are moments in the life of Jesus where he doesn't have time to breathe, let alone to stop for a wedding. This isn't one of them. There are no mobs following Jesus, chasing him from place to place. I'm going to read a passage to you a little later in this sermon where that's exactly what's happening. Jesus is so busy, he can't get away. No crowds, no mobs, no demons shouting at him. Art thou the Son of God? You know, whatever. Cast us out into these pigs. Nothing like that. No crazy stuff going on. Nothing strange out of the ordinary. No helpless widows asking for aid. Everywhere Jesus goes for the rest of his life, there's somebody asking for something. I'm not saying that to be critical of widows. I'm just saying that he was a person who could help people, and everywhere he went, people needed help. So for the rest of his life, he is a person who is helping other people. No one wants Jesus dead at this point. He's not controversial enough to hate. There's no one plotting his demise. If you were in Bible class this morning, in either of our adult classes, we talked a little bit about the trials of Jesus. And there was a lot of hatred and animosity aimed at Jesus. None of that's going. No one cares who Jesus is today. He's just, to put it bluntly, a guy at a wedding. He's just passing through, and that's all that's going on so far. What might Jesus want at this moment? If you're Jesus of Nazareth, and if you know who you are, and if you know what your life's work is quickly becoming, do we begrudge Jesus the desire to have a few days at a wedding, sitting with regular folk, being a regular person, unnoticed, having a bite to eat at the feast, and just being another person in Cana of Galilee? Is that crazy? Folks, if you've ever been in public life, even a little bit, and blessed for all of us, most of us aren't, but if you're in the public eye even a little bit, there are days where you think, I just want to blend into the wallpaper and disappear for a little bit, right? And here's Jesus kind of in reverse, who sees all of that coming, I suspect, or in some sense is aware of it, and just wants to be a fella at a wedding. That's it. That's the goal. And of course, that's not to be. In verse 3, when the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, they have no wine. Why is this? Because remember, Jesus in a moment is going to say, why is this my problem? And before Jesus asks that question, I'm asking that question. Why, if Jesus is a person who just happens to be in town, does Mother Mary come and say, well, we're out of wine? Why is this Jesus' problem? Let me just throw this out. This has been being a little bit speculative, so don't chisel it in stone. But it's something to think about. My first question was, why is this Jesus' problem? You know, it might actually be a little bit Jesus' problem. And my point is this. Why do supplies run out? So last week we had our youth area-wide event down the hall, and I was in charge of ordering chicken. Really simple job, right? You pick up the phone, you order chicken. I didn't know it involves a degree in mathematics, but apparently it does. So you kind of calculate, you get these whimsical RSVPs from youth ministers all over Tulsa. Well, between 1 and 30 of us will be there. And you try to do the math and you figure it all out. And you get it all down pat and you order chicken. Easy, right? An hour before our youth rally, I won't name the guilty parties, but a particular church, of whom I'm no longer on speaking terms, a particular church that we like just fine, called up and said, hey, you're having that thing tonight, aren't you? And I said, yeah. Well, we're going to come. I said, yeah, how many? Oh, 20 or so. I didn't have that number in my count. And so what do? I immediately lose my mind. I call up the chicken place, add 100 pieces of chicken, and then I send Debbie on a wild run to Sam's, get more cookies and everything, you know, more everything. We're going to run out. The church was confused. They were going to a different event. They never arrived, and we had a lot of leftover chicken. I had counted perfectly, and they messed me up. Why do you run out of food? Because somebody shows up who you didn't plan on being there. If you're planning dinner for 6 and 10 more people show up, it's not exactly your fault, right? So Jesus is passing through, and they invite him to dinner. Why do supplies run out? Because someone unexpected show up. Why does someone unexpected at this wedding? Because it wasn't just Jesus. Jesus is strange enough, but it's Jesus plus 5. Right? These disciples are just with Jesus. And you can't very well say, well, Jesus, you're welcome to come eat our food, but these other fellows we don't know, they need to wait outside. No, it's impolite, not good hospitality. And so a very poor town, very poor family, having a wedding, Jesus comes and his 5 hungry friends, young fisherman type, right? And they say, of course you're welcome. And Mary comes around and says, we're out. It's not exactly his fault. It's not exactly not his fault either. So for what it's worth, in Mary's defense, there might have been a reason she went to talk to Jesus that day. It's a very ordinary story at this point, and I think that has its own beauty. What Jesus responds in verses 4 through 5, and Jesus said to her, woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come. His mother said to the servants, do whatever he tells you. Why would Jesus respond in this way? First thing on the word woman, just as a side note, the word woman, unlike kind of the way we say it in English, woman, right? It's inherently kind of disrespectful to say that. In the language of Jesus, doesn't have that same sentiment. The other place in John where Jesus uses this exact same word in the exact same way is at the cross, when he says to Mary, woman, behold your son. Son, behold your mother. And it's the exact same word used in the exact same way. And nobody thinks Jesus is at the cross saying, woman, behold your son. No, nobody thinks he's being rude or antagonistic. It's a deeply affectionate statement in the way that he's using it. Woman, what does this have to do with me? Mother, what does this have to do with me? Would be another way of rendering it. Mother, what does this have to do with me? The question still remains, what does this have to do with me? Because I think we see Jesus here wanting one last peaceful breath. I'm just here at a wedding. There are big things in store for the life of Jesus. And this wedding wasn't really one of them. And yet Mary's response is so telling. Does Mary seem deeply offended? No, it doesn't say anything. Does Mary seem like she's been told off by Jesus and stomps away to go look for a pantry somewhere with some more food and wine in it? No. Instead, she just simply says, do whatever he tells you. What does Mary know that we don't? She knows her son. And while she understands in some way that he just doesn't want to be bothered, she fully expects that he's going to do something about it, and it's going to be amazing. And what is it going to be? What does she expect? Does she expect, you know what, he's going to turn water into wine? I don't know if she has that specifically in mind. But in her mind, once Jesus knows about the problem is fixed. Jesus is the kind of person that when he knows that something needs to be done, she can walk away knowing it's just going to get done. So do whatever he tells you. Jesus at this option has two options. At this moment has two options of how to respond to this particular situation. Option one is fairly simple. Tell himself this isn't his wedding, not his circus, not his monkeys, not his problem, and let the wine be somebody else's problem today. And I got to tell you, you could read the Gospel of John, and if that was the way the story went, none of us would begrudge Jesus even a little bit. We'd say, why are they trying to make him that problem anyway? On other occasions, sometimes Jesus does turn away problems. Do you remember there's an occasion where two brothers come to him, and one of them says, hey, make my brother divide the inheritance between us. And Jesus says, I'm not the judge. Where are you coming to me with this problem? But Jesus doesn't have a problem saying, I'm not the person to ask about that. That would be a legitimate option. It's just not the option that Jesus takes, and it rarely is. Option two is a little more difficult. He could decide to help anyway. He could decide to get involved. And that is a bigger choice than we appreciate. At the end of this story, after, as we know, the miracle probably goes, the water turns to wine, they take it to the master of the feast, he's deeply impressed. He said, usually you do it the other way around. And then at the end, in verse 11, it says, this, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Catch that? Jesus has been under the radar up to this moment. The way that's worded there in verse 11, even his disciples are there because they believed in John. John had credibility. John pointed to Jesus. Okay, five of us will follow Jesus. Jesus is under the radar. Jesus is not important. Jesus is just a man passing through town. When he does this, that is over. No more private life. No more citizen Jesus. From this day forward, he is declaring himself publicly to be the Messiah, the manifestation of the glory of God. Hide it under a bushel? No. Jesus now has to let it shine. Who he is unveiled. And there's no going back from that. This is the first of many, many miracles to go. And it begins a road, and Jesus knows where that road leads. I told you, I'm really fascinated that John throws in a completely meaningless sentiment at the beginning of the story. On the third day, this happened. It's interesting because the third day comes up again in verse 19. A few verses later, Jesus, now after this miracle, is down at the temple. And he says, destroy this temple, and on the third day I'll rise it up again. The third day references are kind of interesting in this particular chapter. That one led to the other. That there is a beginning, a very innocent event, a very simple action, a very out-of-the-way place is going to lead its way back to Jerusalem someday, to a cross, and to a painful death. This is the beginning of that story. And I think we can understand why Jesus, in a little bit of exasperation, says, it's not my hour. One more meal, one more quiet moment. But then he does it anyway. And that is the moral I'd like to convey to you about this story. Jesus, the man who does it anyway. Throughout the life of Jesus, he is often a person who has every excuse and reason to walk away from the problems of other people, and yet insists on being powerfully and meaningfully involved in other people's lives. Let me just pause and skip over to another chapter. In Matthew, the 14th chapter, probably my favorite individual chapter. I know it's weird. Who has a favorite chapter? I do. Matthew chapter 14, in the life of Christ, I think it's the most interesting series of stories strung together in the four Gospels. Matthew 14 tells what it's like to live a day in the shoes of Jesus, not at the wedding of Cana of Galilee, but after that. Once the veil has come off and glory is revealed and he is who he is and the mobs are following him, who is Jesus and who does he have to become? In Matthew chapter 14, the first 12 verses tell a side story about how John, the cousin of Jesus, the man we said was actually well known when Jesus wasn't, is executed by Herod. What do you do when Herod executes your cousin, someone you care for and love? What do we do? We were at a wedding a second ago in John chapter 2. We'd like there to be a funeral. And not only a funeral, we'd like to have a time for mourning. We'd like to lick our wounds a little bit. We'd like to sit back and be quiet. And that's exactly what Jesus wants to do. In chapter 14, verse 13, now when Jesus heard this, he withdrew from there to a boat to a desolate place by himself. Jesus is the Son of God, but Jesus is also the Son of Man. And when his cousin dies, he just wants to be left alone. And so he tries to wander off a little bit and get a little distance. How's that work out for him? Verse 13 concludes, but when the crowds heard it, they followed him on foot from the towns. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them and healed their sick. If there was ever a moment where Jesus could say, could you just leave me alone for a minute? You were sick yesterday, you're going to be sick tomorrow. Today, I just need a little bit of me time. Could you leave me be? This would be a perfectly good example of a place to do it. Jesus goes off by himself, mob follows him, and Jesus doesn't say, get out of here. Jesus starts healing people that are sick until he completely runs out of steam. In verse 15 to 21, the crowd, it turns out, is very hungry. Is this Jesus' fault? This is the 3:30 phone call. Hey, we're bringing 20 more people, right? Get more chicken. But no, it's 5,000 men and as many women and children. He didn't ask them there. You know why he didn't have lunch for those many people? Because he was there by himself. He went to be by himself, not to feed 5,000 men. But here they are. Couldn't Jesus just say, not my circus, not my monkey, not my problem, and walk away from the whole thing? He sure could. He doesn't. Instead, he starts multiplying food until they feed the entire crowd to the shock and dismay of all his disciples. And when that's over, I don't know what's involved in feeding 5,000 people, but I imagine he might be tired. At the end of that, he tries to do what he started doing at the beginning of the chapter, which was to have a quiet day for himself. And so in verse 22 and 23, immediately he made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. And when evening came, he was there alone. Remember, this is the same day. He just wants a moment to himself. How's that work out for him? His disciples, who by the way are fishermen, out in the middle of the sea, wind up in trouble. Maybe to the point of perishing. Is this Jesus' problem? Jesus isn't a fisherman. Jesus isn't a sailor. If anybody has a problem, surely it's the fellows in the boat and they can take care of it. But that's not Jesus' response. Instead of turning water into wine, he walks on water and makes his way out to the middle of the sea and instills in them faith and courage. When they get to the other side, does Jesus finally get a break? In verse 34 and following, and when they had crossed over, they came to land at Gennesaret. And when the men of that place recognized him, they sent around to all that region and brought to him all who were sick and implored him that they might only touch the fringe of his garment. And he says, what is this to do with me? My hour has not yet come. No. And as many as touched it were made well. My point is that Jesus is this sort of person. And we get the first glimpse of it in the wedding of Cana of Galilee. He is the kind of person who doesn't turn away from the needs of other people. He recognizes his own needs. Folks, there is a time for rest. There is a time to give yourself a break. There is a time for peace and quiet. I'm a big believer in that. I really do believe that. And Jesus tries to have that on many occasions. But at the end of the day, there's a time for rest, and there is also a time for selfless service. And Jesus knows the difference. And Mary knows he knows the difference. And so when he says, it's not my hour, she doesn't say, yes, of course it is. She says, do whatever he tells you. And she fully expects that he'll be that person. We desperately need to become that kind of people. There is a time to rest the hands of weary Christian servants. There is also a time for work to be done. There is so much work to be done in this community and in this congregation. And we don't have the luxury of all of us taking a break at the same time. We need teachers in our Bible classes. We need service at our projects. We need leaders in our worship. We need mentors for our young. We need people in every area of service. And there is a reason why you're not. And it's probably a really good reason. It's just that when I look at the life of Jesus Christ, I find out it wasn't that good after all. There is a time to pick up the task that needs to be done and to get back to work. And brethren, you have that opportunity. And I have that same confidence that you will. Be poured out. Have your life put to use. I do not want to get to the end of my life and be able to tell God, look at all this energy and strength and resources I saved up and never used. Wasn't I thrifty? I want to get to the end with my tank on empty and say, I don't have anything left. I hope you do. This is the sentiment of the Apostle Paul in Philippians chapter 2 and verse 17. Even if I am to be poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrificial offering of your faith, I am glad and rejoice with you all. If there is work to be done, be glad that it's there. Be glad that there is an opportunity for goodness in a fallen and sick world and that you have the ability to do something about it. Take up your hands and do the work of a servant. This may be the first of many things to come. Respond to the gospel invitation. This same Lord who has shown himself so fully sacrificial will go to a cross for every one of us. And at that hour, if ever there was an hour when he could say, it's really not my problem this time, I didn't do the sinning, and I shouldn't be doing the dying, that should have been the day for it. But that has never been the attitude of Jesus our Lord. He says, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do, and pays the price for the crimes we've committed. Today, respond to that gospel and to that Lord in faith and obedience. We're going to sing a word of encouragement. If we can do anything to help you, won't you come?